What's your last name, Jill?
My maiden name was Owens, but I'm Spafford.
You took Spafford.
Yeah.
Hi, my name is Mark Nelson. I am 40 years old, and today is August 1st, 2008. We are in Foley Square in Lower Manhattan, and I'm here with my friend Joshua Spafford and his wife, Jill.
Owens.
I know Spafford. You just asked me that, but Jill okay. Spafford. Tired, sorry.
Either
as
one.
Usual. As usual, Joshua.
I'm Joshua Spafford. I'm 35. It's still August 1st at the StoryCorps booth in Foley Square in downtown Manhattan.
Over to you, Jill.
I'm Jill Spafford. I am 24, and it's amazingly still August 1st, and we're in Foley Square with my husband Josh and Mark Nelson.
Hi, guys.
Hi.
This is part 6 of our discussion about your grandfather, George Hodel. I listened to the recordings of last time, and I have to say I'm so embarrassed when I call him your father. I hope you know that this comes out of 4 years of talking to Steve about his father.
I understand. Yeah. People make that mistake all over my family. They jumble everyone up together, so don't worry about it.
And I also realized I know why Jill is here today. You've been listening to the recordings, and you realize that Joshua is not being forthcoming, that you both do actually know that George killed the Black Dahlia and that you're here to clear it all up, right?
It's the truth. No.
We'll all right, well, thanks for 5 minutes.
Okay, well, thanks for coming anyway.
Thank you.
I'm just going to ramble for a second. We've got two parts to today's last session. The first is I just want to kind of talk through the Black Dahlia generally. We've already been over your grandfather and the possibility of, did he do it or didn't he do it? I don't think we can cover that ground any better than we have. And we're really going to lead into ending today with a little talk about what you're doing with your play. But first, let's just talk about California in the 1940s and the Black Dahlia a little bit more broadly, because it's an amazing story, regardless of how your grandfather fits into it. The Black Dahlia murder was, to my mind, incredibly audacious, flawlessly executed, and it remains unsolved. 60 years later, people are still trying to figure this out. Partly this is a search for the killer, partly this is a search for the motive, and partly this is a search for precedent. As humans, I think we're a little more comfortable when we have a precedent, like something we can latch on to help us understand this seemingly unmanageable, impossible murder. And because the record on this is so polluted and so convoluted, we're sort of left to our own devices. So when you look at photographs of the body of Elizabeth Short dead on the ground or on the morgue table, it's easy to imagine that whoever killed her did so in part because he or they took pleasure in administering pain. But like any other statement you could make about the night she was killed, it's rife with speculation. With the exception of what we can glean from the documents or the photographs, we have really only, I guess, our imagination to work with. So with regard to precedent, the question becomes, what can other murders tell you about the Black Dahlia murder? And the answer seems to be very little. If you look to other murders, you can find really no clear precedent. There are murders where the body was moved to disguise its relation to the murder site. There are murders where the body was damaged in any number of unimaginable ways or imaginable ways. There are murders where the body was posed. There are mob murders and rage murders and deviant murders, but none of them seem to convey the same level of abject cunning, if you will. So since we can't look to other murders to find an answer, in our book, Sarah and I, we attempt to offer a theory that speaks to define this precedent. We do offer a suspect, your grandfather, but we don't necessarily speak to motive. Lust, rage, envy, jealousy, money, these are motives. And it's conceivable that making an homage to surrealism could be a precedent, or it could be a motive, but it's less likely. What maybe is more likely is that the killing was done through some kind of traditional motive, like rage or like, you know, jealousy, but then the afterthought, the murder became, or the positioning of the body, the carving up of the body, let's say the turning of it into a surrealist artwork, could have been actually an afterthought. Once it's done, now let's proceed with this other part of it. So just for a little clarification of backstory on this last tape, specifically in our book, we argue two things: that whoever killed Elizabeth Short disfigured her body in a manner after surrealism, and secondly, that works by Man Ray, William Copley, and Marcel Duchamp, who were three best friends, and most poignantly, Duchamp's Etant Donné, which is one of the most famous pieces of contemporary art now, may contain coded references to the Black Dahlia murder. Now, this argument seems loopy when you just say it out loud, but when you consider that we've been able to tie together social networks, time frame, geography, and visual comparison, the argument becomes much harder to write off. Which brings me to my long-winded point here. The theory is a nuanced theory, though, and it suggests a number of divergent possibilities. So what I thought I could offer by way of this last conversation here is just to start off the discussion with a little exercise at looking at how you can imagine many scenarios within the framework of our theory. One of them might be that George Hodel did it, but another might be that he didn't do it. So we might not be able to ever really figure out who killed Elizabeth Short, but we could use facts as a measure along an imagined scale of probability to gauge how far off we might be from the truth. So, for example, if I were to make a statement like, Marcel Duchamp killed the Black Dahlia, well, we know for a fact that this is impossible. Along our scale of probability, this is impossible. We know that he was on a boat in the middle of the Atlantic on that exact date, so therefore, that's not possible. If you make another statement like, Marcel Duchamp's Etant Donné is modeled after the Black Dahlia murder, you start to find yourself moving along the gradation into a scale of possibility. Like, well, that's possible. There's nothing to say it's impossible, but you're nowhere, sort of, you haven't really gained any ground yet. If you then say that Man Ray, who is Marcel Duchamp's best friend, was very good friends with prime suspect George Hodel, now all of a sudden you've moved a little bit closer along the lines of the question you've, along the probability scale, along the lines of the question you've asked, is the Etant Donné modeled after the Black Dahlia murder? So when you consider, then you start to consider other things like, well, if that's the case, then did George Hodel murder the Black Dahlia? Well, maybe, but maybe not, because the Black Dahlia murder enamored people, and I mean, people were enamored with it. They just couldn't get enough of it in Los Angeles. George Hodel could have just been interested like anyone else and could have gotten some photographs through a pal, popped them on over to Man Ray. Roland Brown, who was your grandmother's open lover at that time, was good friends with Gene Fowler, and his son Will Fowler was one of the first reporters at the scene of the crime. Photographs move through these circles. Hollywood is a very tight, very defined community. So I thought if we could just talk about that a little bit, like our understanding of Hollywood and the art angle and looking at probability. What do you think about that?
It's interesting. Whenever I think about the project, but when I say project, the play that I've been working on with Jill about my experience in Steve Hodel's theory, one of the more, I guess I could say, enjoyable aspects of doing it is trying to imagine this community of people in 1947 and prior, and even afterwards too, even a couple of years afterwards until the end of my grandfather's stay there, because I don't know too much about it, but I do know that the convergence of these minds of the artists there and maybe even a person like my grandfather being involved in all that, something was happening, something formative and unique. And what I would love to know, and maybe you can tell me, and I know you'll have an answer for this, is was this event, was this terrible murder, was there any previous murders like it? You know, there are a lot of different aspects to the event of the murder that, to me, or let's just say the uninformed, they smack of like almost a grade B movie in a way. Just the mailing, the letters afterwards, if perhaps those weren't even connected, you know, catch me if you can, that whole aspect, the way that remained in the press for quite a while, just that sensational aspect to it. I don't know if that was in the air or if that is something unique and new. What I'm coming to is I've always just tried to figure out why this event, this case, has stayed on the way it has. You know, Jack the Ripper is a much larger and more obvious example, but in a way it's like the little sister of it in terms of its notoriety. And I don't know why. I don't know why that is. And I wish it wasn't now, especially that they're saying it was my grandfather. But maybe you can tell me why you think this has stayed on for so long.
Well, I think like I said, it's partially just unsolved. I mean, that makes people crazy. But it's also just so audacious, you know? I mean, it really speaks to something. Let's say you shoot somebody, right? And you even pose them. You know, you wait for the cops to come. You put your mom, who you just shot, in a chair and you pose her. I mean, those things exist all through the histories of various crimes. But with this one, you know, I was talking to James Burns, James and his wife Barbara, who were friends with Man Ray and Gloria de Herrera at the time, and they said it was just everywhere. You couldn't go to a cocktail party without talking about it. They named their car Dahlia something. I can't remember exactly.
Oh my gosh.
You know how people give nicknames to their cars. Mm-hmm. They had given the nickname Dahlia to their car.
That's pretty macabre.
Which he couldn't actually remember. You know, he's quite elderly now. He couldn't quite remember the relationship, but somehow it just spoke to that time. And it was a very special time. You know, there are moments where things tend to congeal in American history or in any history of any country, where if you look at L.A. in the 40s, something really unique and amazing is going on there. In our book, for example, we have laid out what we call a web of connections, showing how your grandfather was connected into the arts and the cultural community and the movie community also. I should say those people in the movie industry who were interested in the arts, that's the overlap. And it's easy to look at that chart and say, oh, well, there's Vincent Price and there's Edward G. Robinson on there. And there's Marcel Duchamp. Look at these people. They just cobbled together a bunch of celebrities and they put them all together for the value of having the celebrity name on the chart. But actually, thinking about history and rolling yourself back in history, what's important to do is to remember that those names look fabulous to us now because they've been canonized. They're part of the understood canon of the history of film and art. But at the time, these men were working. I say men, even though there's some women on the chart. Mostly these men were working actors and artists in mid-career, not nearly as famous as they are now. Famous, certainly, but and they all hung out together. And this isn't us just inventing this. This is a well-known part of, and becoming an even better known part, because a lot of people are focusing now, historians are focusing more on California in the 40s, but this is a known fact about these communities in Hollywood, and it is undoubtedly your grandfather was participating in this. You could look at it as a series of concentric overlapping circles of friends, lovers, and business acquaintances that, you know, sometimes got together in this little group and sometimes got together in that little group and sometimes all came together at a big art opening or movie premiere or whatever. But, you know, they're all partiers too. They love to party, these guys. Except for maybe Man Ray, who always said that he stood in the corner with a highball, you know, grumbling. You know, Steve, for example, tries to claim in his book that Man Ray might have known this. This is another question for our probability chart. Did Man Ray know, did Marcel Duchamp know that your grandfather killed the Black Dahlia and then covered it up? Along our probability chart, that's pretty unlikely. Probably not. Could Man Ray have killed or been involved in the killing? Highly unlikely, because the guy just didn't, you know, if you read his letters, you realize he's kind of a neurotic mess, and a picture doesn't get painted of a guy that could have done it.
I guess it goes.
Well, let me just finish that point real quick.
Sure.
Could Man Ray possibly have suspected that he got an uneasy feeling from his pal George? Now we're entering maybe more the realm of possibility. It becomes conversational with his friend William Copley or Marcel Duchamp. Did you know that George is a suspect? Now all of a sudden these three guys have a real reason to be interested in this.
When does Man Ray leave LA?
He leaves LA in 1951, pretty long after the murder. I mean, he leaves in 1947 for a trip in the summer. And, you know, in Steve's book, he tries to infer that this might be because Man Ray was running away from questioning. But actually, we know for a fact from the letters that are housed at the Getty that he was planning that trip prior to the time of the murder. So there's just no way that those two things are linked. And we also know that he doesn't flee the country when George Hodel does, which is in 1950. He's got no reason to. He leaves in 1951 for probably the stated reasons that he's given all along, which are just he was sick of LA and wanted to move back to Paris.
Right.
So it's completely impossible in my mind that Man Ray had anything to do with the murder. This is, you know, you see this in the media a lot. Man Ray tied to murder. No. Maybe Man Ray interested in murder, maybe making art, but that is also extremely common. Go to any art school, go into the fine art studios, and what will you see up on the wall? Go to any artist studio, you'll see a whole bunch of pictures all over the wall, visual source references, things they're interested in. Completely common. Why couldn't the Black Dahlia have been one of those things?
Right.
That's actually a pretty logical standpoint or viewpoint to take. It doesn't imply any collusion or any kind of, you know, conspiracy. It's just we're interested.
A couple of questions for you. If it's true that the murder of Elizabeth Short, or at least the way she was presented or found, was either an act of surrealism or a gesture or a nod towards it, if that is true, and if it was somehow proven that my grandfather was not the murderer, what could you discern from that? Would you still say that it was still an act of surrealism? And how available or present were the ideas of surrealism in that time? How, you know, was it in its heyday? Had it died down? How present was it in the collective sort of consciousness of people?
Well, to answer the first part of that question, yeah, I think that's both the strength and the weakness of our theory. Because remember, it's a theory that the murder could have been an act of surrealism. If George was found to be innocent, that doesn't necessarily make that theory in and of itself go away.
Right.
Why we're at George right now is because we've already talked about George, the seeming pattern of pathological abuse, the drugs, the using drugs as a way to seemingly subdue or harm women, which is, you look at Ruth Spaulding, you look at Lillian Lenorak, and again, you also look at Tamar's daughter, Deborah. We've not talked about that incident at all, but that's three known three incidences of drugs in relation to subduing women, and so on and so forth. So you have a pattern of a person that's a suspect. You know he's a prime suspect, but in addition to that, we also know that he was very interested in surrealism. He's even on the district attorney transcripts talking about surrealism, and his photo, he's showing his surrealist photographs to some girls at the party.
Yeah.
We know from all the oral histories of your family that he was into surrealism. I suppose it would weaken the argument a little bit, simply because part of the argument is based on his interest in surrealism. That's where this whole theory kind of came out of.
Right.
To find another suspect that fit all those profiles and also was interested in surrealism, yeah, okay, maybe it's starting to be a stretch. To answer the second part of your question, surrealism, you know, starts in 1924, and it's still going on today. There are still people that actively call themselves surrealists, but its heyday really ends right about the time of the murder in 1947.
Oh, really?
That's kind of when what we think of as classical mid-century or early century surrealism is starting to wane. It's already made its way into the public consciousness. Surreal is the word you now know and use because it was everywhere. And I think we've already mentioned, for example, that in Life magazine, just prior to the murder, you've got a picture of Dolly,
right,
by Dolly, of a woman cut in half. And, you know, I just found the other day, strangely, I can't believe I never even saw this before, but a cartoon from the Los Angeles Times in which there we have a surrealist sort of mannequin for the Dolly party laid out in the grass. So when we were looking, to answer that question, when we were looking for precedent, we were not looking at the hundreds of publications that George Hodel could not have seen or probably wouldn't have seen, because there are hundreds, literally hundreds. We were looking for just things that were common. What Life magazine, it's common.
Yeah.
You know, this is not something hidden, basically. And even if you look at Mary Passios's, I hope I'm pronouncing her name right, if you look at her theory, which goes back to Orson Welles and The Lady of Shanghai, and she's got this whole theory built up around, again, she's looking for precedent. She looks to this sort of jumble of dolls. Well, where does that come from? Again, that probably comes from surrealism.
Yeah.
You know, it's common.
Yeah.
Certainly by that point, it's common. So we've hit the halfway mark here, and part of what we want to talk about is where you're moving next. I've told you I'm trying to move out of Black Dahlia land. Can't seem to quite get myself out, but you're not exactly moving into it, but you're going to stay a little bit longer. What are you working on? Can you talk about your play a little bit?
It's like a midpoint. I don't know, that's true. It could be the beginning. It's hard to say. So how to summarize it? Sometime before even Steve's book came out, I've been fascinated with the ideas of legacy and paternal legacy, and I've been kind of obsessed by it, mm-hmm. just because of the men in my life. They're really dynamic and crazy and difficult and challenging men in my life that I've had from my father who raised me, and George, those being kind of the...
But you mean stepfather, Barry Deeney?
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah. I never knew my biological father. But
and he also certainly factors into this, too, in a strange way.
He does.
In an absent way.
In an absent way. As a kid, I didn't... He was just sort of the ghost of the father I didn't have, and Barry comes along, and he's just a force of nature, and just comes from a different time. I mean, he was raised by circus vaudevillians and never went to school, and he and I ended up building sailboats from trees we cut down in the Danish forest and sailed around the world. And even then, even growing up, I knew that what I was experiencing was a kind of man or masculinity that was waning, kind of, in a way. Mm-hmm. Just big, brazen, bulldozing men.
Certainly, in our previous discussion, these men that we're talking about are the dying breed of America.
Exactly. And when my relationship with him petered out, you know, the same time as he and my mother had a divorce, I'd already had a relationship with George, but I start working for my grandfather, sort of now my adopted father in some ways. And for myself, I kind of justified, well, how shall I say this? I had been raised priding a lot of qualities in myself that I thought I had learned from Barry. Sort of living by the seat of your pants, being a really wise, something of a hustler, being very worldly and speaking many languages. And just a kind of brute force of your personality will get you through anything, kind of belief in yourself. And when that fell apart, I just kind of looked to George and said to myself, well, if I'm from this stock, I must be okay, because he's got it all figured out. Mm-hmm. So I guess what I'm coming to say is I've had a fascination and a weird relationship, a difficult relationship, because as I entered early adulthood, you're getting to know yourself a little bit, and I was finding who I was and trying to be them to a large degree, and I also lived abroad a lot. I say abroad, but I lived either in Asia or Europe. And then I find myself as a young man here in New York City, and sometimes being a circus vaudevillian from 1942 or a womanizing Playboy doctor from 1947 didn't really gel well living in downtown New York. Anyways, so I've been obsessed with these ideas about generational masculine shift.
Well, let's take a minute here just to help, if anyone does listen to this, understand. Yeah. So, because backstory.
Sure.
So you work here in New York. You become an actor, right? You become successful at that.
And I had been acting for even a decade prior to my move to New York, and in part of my challenge was I had been quite successful already. I had been an MTV VJ. I had been on soap operas in the Far East, and I grew bored of that, and the success was easy, and I wanted to challenge myself. So I came here, and I was challenged.
But yeah, and you have you've sort of worked your way up that ladder now.
That's what I've spent 10 years here in New York doing. Yeah.
Right. And am I wrong in thinking that? Give us some examples. Were you in the early production of Angels in America? Maybe
I was in the Asian premiere. Yeah. Okay. And I was in Les Mis and things like that. I mean, it's hard to qualify what success is. I've been a working actor, and
we're just basically establishing that you actually now have reason to now move this into the area of a play.
Sure, yeah. I've spent almost 19 years making theater now around the world. And I guess two things happened. One, I was hungry just to... I spent about 8 years developing neoclassical theater downtown, and I'm interested in new forms and just new angles on contemporary theater. So that was kind of eating away at me. Then this experience happened.
Meaning Steve's 2003, book.
Yeah, it's Steve's book.
Mm-hmm.
And I got married. Hi, wife.
Hey, what's up?
And I was planning on doing Hamlet. All these things sort of happened at the same time.
Well, let's change course here. Let's have a question for Jill. So
she kind of was the linchpin for all this. She told me to do this.
Yeah, I think you've watched Joshua struggle through this question here. So let's let's get another perspective on it.
Like, uh-huh.
What's he going through in terms of making this, and how did this come about? What is this thing?
Well, I think I'm in a funny position with regard to this because I have a little bit of an outsider's perspective and also an insider's perspective, because this book came out before we met. That's so right. Yeah. he had been dealing with it, and his family had been dealing with this terrible possibility for already a year and a half by the time we met. So when we started talking about the book and a reaction to it, and where do we, you know, what does this mean for us? We started out from a point of view of no way. This is just a fantasy garbage, coming basically. From one man's brain.
Right.
There's also a lot of hatred involved towards.
Yeah. From the whole family. I think you knew that, and I sensed it. And it took a while, honestly, for us to even entertain any kind of discussion about this, because it just seems like something so. That can be so easily hidden and brushed under the carpet because it's easier. So when we started talking about the book and about just, you know, what do we have a reaction to it? Do we even have a reaction to it? You know, do we even entertain it enough to respond?
It's clear that we had one because we were obsessed with it.
Right.
And I think... what happened was the question became, how do we personally respond to this in some kind of productive way, productive for us, because we're consumed with it. So what to do with that?
Mm-hmm.
I can't afford a high priced therapist every day.
Right. And I think from my point of view, I saw Josh getting tired of not talking about it, or not being able to talk about it, or not having anybody to talk about it with, meaning that he couldn't get his mother's point of view, and he couldn't get his grandmother's point of view, because he knew what it was and they didn't want to discuss it. So, so where do you turn with something like that? You have to find some way and
an outlet. For
yeah. It. And you know, I think one of our first things we said is, you know, we want to make sure this is not a vanity project, you know, that we're just not doing something like, oh, well, you know, this could be people will be into this. It was really more that we couldn't not do something. So I think this started to come about. I think, you know, knowing his background in neoclassical theater here in New York, and his background in theater in general, and my background in theater, we just started thinking about possibilities. And at that point, you were talking with a director friend about doing a production of Hamlet. And that discussion went on for, I think, several years without going to fruition. But she, you know, entertained stories of this project, and she connected us with the playwright. Pete Seth Bauer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, certainly your story has so many classical narrative.
It's true, like, know, in many ways, yeah. preparing
it resonates for
Hamlet
with Shakespeare in so many different ways. You can't
sort of
even
haunted by this huge, larger-than-life ghost male figure and yeah. and living up to his shadow. These things segue, and as the production of Hamlet that I was supposed to do kind of petered out, this just became apparent. At the same time, I guess because we had been preparing Hamlet, I knew a couple things. I knew that I didn't want to be a curio. I didn't want to be like a freak show. I mean, maybe I am to a small degree. But in telling this story, I wanted it less to be like, look how weird my family is, which it is, but more along the lines of, look how weird all our families are, mine being an uber extreme mm-hmm. archetypical example, and how do you deal with wrestling gigantic demons, right?
Well, and I always felt like he had like so many stories to tell. I mean, when we were first getting acquainted, it just seemed like every time he told a story of his past, it was just like, people have to know about this, you know? Right. It's so...
Because it is bigger than life.
It's totally bigger than life. It's not necessarily better or worse. It's just he has had a very unique experience in many ways with regard to many different things and people. And I just felt like instead of doing the Hamlet that everybody's done, his is more interesting to me. So I would rather see that.
Right.
I know we're almost there in time, but if I've taken any good from creating this play, I won't even get the title because the title's changing every day now, but
right.
The Dahlia Reverie for today. It's that I've reached out to a lot of other men, creative types, Seth Bauer, say, and other people. And I've heard from them in a way that I've never heard before about how they have really struggled being handed or living in the legacy of these huge male challenging types, because part of us or part of me or part of them wants to claim certain aspects of their behavior because it can be helpful to get through life, and part of that is a bit of a dying breed, and it's totally misogynistic and unproductive. So
certainly the absent father is one of the or the son reaching for the father is one of the narratives of life. And
yeah.
I mean, people just have made the point recently, Obama, he doesn't write about the loving warm mother in
right.
his book. He writes about the absent father.
That's interesting.
And even William Copley, who Billy Copley, the son of William Copley, who Sarah and I came to know, you know, we had a really interesting moment where we needed to get that picture of the Midnight Doctor for the book, and we went into Billy, nervous as all get out, to say, can we have that picture? And he looked at our book and he said, well, that was my father. He didn't judge the material or get upset by it. He didn't mean my father had anything to do with the Black Dahlia murder. He simply meant, this is what my father was into, this kind of pictures of women like this. And it's clear that he and his sister Claire are dealing with the same issues, the big father, you know. So the big father is bigger than life, and it's very confusing to deal with that person.
Yeah.
So I think we probably have, what, a minute left or something? 2 minutes left. So it's kind of time to say our goodbyes, I guess. But one thing that occurs to me in saying goodbye is that, obviously thanks to StoryCorps, because this has been a really amazing experience, I find.
For me. Remarkable.
Also, I really worry about your Uncle Steve sometime. I just kind of like to close in saying that.
Yeah.
I feel like I don't have the family baggage to bring to this, so
yeah.
it's much easier now for me to move on to other things,
yeah.
you know. And I'm hoping that he's going to somehow not end his life in some kind of cesspool of, like, you know, anxiety. So I don't know what you guys are going to do about that, but I would hope you don't go down that hole either, you know.
No, I mean, what I...
Because what happens
what
is
I
you
fail
get...
to say is I'm not done with this project, but even now at the halfway point, it's been totally cathartic.
Yeah.
The fact that I'm here discussing this, I hope, is some indicator of that.
Yeah.
Just to be able to let it go.
Yeah, letting it go.
Letting
yeah.
it go.
Letting it, or letting it be, maybe.
Letting it be, or the combination of that and being okay. I might not be okay in saying I don't know today, but I certainly am on some days, and I'm certainly aspiring to going there.
Right.
In my entirety.
Well, I wish you guys both a lot of success in finishing up this project, and I'll be there at the premiere.
All right.
Thanks.
Take it easy.